it's a great pleasure and honor to welcome, I should actually say welcome back, Philip Ludwigendorff to this building, this department, and to the South Asia Seminar. I was asking Philip how best I should describe him, because he does so many things and does them in really interesting and thought-provoking ways. His interests are in folklore, religion, literature, popular culture, and really both his books, the first one being The Life of a Text, performing the Ramcharitmanas of Tulsidas. It came out in 1991. Mm-hmm. From the University of California Press. And more recently, Hanuman's Tale, The Message of a Divine Monkey, which came out of Columbia University
no,
Press.
No, Oxford.
Oh, Oxford. His books bear the stamp of his many interests. In addition, Philip, he's just been giving me all his stuff, or some of his stuff on Hindi cinema, and he's the author of two really influential articles on Hindi films. One is Who Wants to Be a Goddess, which is a fascinating study of the Santoshi Ma phenomenon. And another, which is a more theoretical study of something that he calls provocatively an Indian way of filmmaking. Or is there an Indian way of filmmaking?
Is there an Indian way of filmmaking? It's a homage to Raman, of course.
Well. Yeah. So I won't go on. I mean, I could go on. But today I think he's going to, again, bring all of these interests together and talk about the persistence of the mythological in Hindi cinema. So once again, welcome.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Let me begin by paying tribute to one of my teachers who had the kindness to come today, Professor Kali Charan Behal. Who actually was the person who suggested the topic that became the basis of The Life of a Text. And I am forever in his debt for that. It was a point at which I needed to change my PhD topic on short notice for reasons that I won't go into here. And he came up with the idea of a study of the living oral traditions of Tulsi Ramayana. And it became a wonderful thing for me. So. Anyway, I want to thank him for that. Now, I just want to say, this is a very image-oriented talk, so you might want to move your chairs a little bit. Make sure you can see well.
Bring your chair.
Yeah, and we'll shut out the room lights in a sec. And also, there's a little bit of introductory remarks in the talk. I've given this talk in a number of places, and sometimes to audiences that are not as savvy about South Asian popular culture as you all are. So I may risk repeating a few kind of obvious generalities at the beginning, but I'll quickly, I hope, get into the meat or the kofta, if you prefer, of the argument. So we can begin with the often heard cliché film industry in the world. And of course, this is, can you shut the room lights off? This is generally statistically accurate, at least in terms of output, with roughly 600 to 900 new films per year since the late 1970s emerging from several regional film centers. The most lucrative and widely distributed of these film industries, although it accounts for only about a third of output, and the focus of my remarks today is the Hindi language cinema based in Mumbai, Bombay. This, as you know, has lately acquired the media label Bollywood, which has become a sort of juggernaut that there is no stopping, even though it was originally a rather pejorative term used by journalists in the English language media. It has now acquired worldwide recognition, even though it remains somewhat offensive to many, especially in the Bombay film industry, since it suggests a second-hand derivative phenomenon, an Indian imitation of real cinema, which is based someplace else. The problem with this label, the Bollywood label, is a good starting point for my remarks today. For I would assert that for most of its history, Indian popular cinema has displayed striking departures from the norms of Euro-American filmmaking, and has steered a notably independent course. Its alternative vision of cinematic possibilities is embodied in such practices as the operatic use of music and dance in films of nearly all genres, the rejection of the so-called invisible style of classic Hollywood in favor of a more self-consciously surreal embrace of cinematic artifice, and its own hyperbolic star system. This alternative approach has won vast audiences in many parts of the world, which remains largely an untold story, in part because of the tendency of area studies to ignore hybrid cultural phenomenon. Indeed, German scholar Lothar Lütze, writing in 1985, described the Hindi film as, quote, perhaps the most powerful cultural product based on non-Western aesthetic principles presently alive, unquote. Today I want to discuss the influence on popular cinema of plot elements ultimately traceable to the great reservoirs of Indic narrative, the classical epics Ramayana and Mahabharata. Although these are commonly classified as scriptures, it is of course well to remember that they are not single texts, but multiform storytelling traditions that have influenced all the religious communities of India. One way in which this influence has been manifested is through productions directly based on these sources, which have come to be known in the film industry under the generic label of mythologicals. Now, this is where I risk recapitulating a very familiar narrative, but I'll do it briefly. Historically, of course, mythologicals played a key role in the beginnings of Indian film. D.G. Palke, the man generally hailed as the father of Indian cinema, was inspired to make what was probably the first Indian feature film in 1913 after viewing a Western film on the life of Jesus and feeling a yearning as much nationalistic as religious to project Indian images and stories on the screen. His first film, Raja Harishchandra, was based on a story from the Mahabharata. Palke went on to make nearly 100 films, mostly based on epic and Puranic stories, and many other filmmakers followed his example. Nearly all of the Indian films made prior to 1920 were of this type, but this soon changed as filmmakers began experimenting with plots based on historical narratives, contemporary social issues, and crime and mystery. Mythologicals continued to be produced periodically, but they were no longer the dominant form. Interestingly, they experienced a brief revival after the introduction of sound in 1931, and in video format after the spread of television in the mid-1980s, as reflected in the massive government-sponsored serializations of Ramayana and Mahabharata on Doordarshan. And also, India's first feature-length animated film, which premiered in the fall of 2005, once again recapitulated this pattern, presenting the mythical biography of one of the most popular Hindu deities, the subject of my recent book. All these examples suggest that mythological storylines helped, in each case, to familiarize Indian filmmakers and their audiences with new technologies and practices, by using them to tell well-known and beloved stories. One might say that they helped Indian filmmakers learn how to make films and Indian audiences learn how to watch them. But once these skills were acquired, interest in the mere repetition of these tales on the screen seems to have declined rapidly, at least in Hindi cinema. As you probably know, mythologicals have had more enduring popularity in some of the cinemas of South India. Within the emerging scholarly literature on popular Indian cinema, the mythological genre has fared especially badly, seemingly regarded as an embarrassment that is best ignored. This is unfortunate both because of the historical importance of the genre and also because of the occasionally successful Hindi mythological, such as the low-budget 1975 film Jai Santoshi Maa, which is certainly deserving of closer observation. This film has received some attention from religious studies scholars because it helped to popularize the worship of a reputedly new goddess, the Santoshi Maa, the mother of satisfaction. I'm going to run a short clip from the beginning of the film, probably familiar to some of you, depicting the circumstances of Santoshi Maa's birth, because it gives you a feeling for some of the conventions of the mythological genre. And hopefully this will work. Inshallah, here we go. Wait a minute.
बहन मनसा, राखी का त्योहार भी कितने आनंद का त्योहार होता है।
बोजी बोजी, हमारे हाथ में राखी बांध दीजिए ना।
बेटा, राखी तो बहन बांधती है। क्या तुम नहीं बांधोगी?
नहीं बेटा।
पिताजी पिताजी हमें भी बहन ला दो ना पिताजी हमें बहन ला दो ना
पिताजी हमें बहन चाहिए
हम भी हमारी बहन से राखी
भी पूरी कर दीजिए। नारायण नारायण, जिनके पिता जगत पूज्य गणेश हो, माताएं ऋद्धि सिद्धि हो, उनके बालक निराश रहे। नारायण नारायण।
मुनिवर ठीक ही कहते हैं भैया।
नारायण नारायण। शिवनंदन, कुछ ऐसा चमत्कार करो जिसे सब नमस्कार करें, सब जय जयकार करें।
बच्चों की इच्छा पूरी कर दीजिए ना प्रभु, इनका मन रख लीजिए ना।
Okay. The inexpensive sets and special effects, and the affectionate and even lighthearted treatment of deities, such as Ganesha, who is here shown being cajoled by his children, wives, and the busybody sage Narada into producing a daughter he doesn't really want, are all typical of the mythological film, as they are of much folk narrative and folk theater. But despite this opening, the film Jai Santoshima is not primarily about gods. Rather, as I've argued in my recent essay, most of the film concerns the travails of an earthly maiden, Satyavati, a devotee of Santoshima, who becomes a young wife in the course of the film and undergoes a series of crises that mirror the anxieties and challenges that many Indian women face as they adjust to life in the extended family of their in-laws. Satyavati's eventual triumph over these adversities parallels Santoshima's rise and acceptance as a legitimate goddess in the pantheon. But if mundane life interpenetrates mythology in Hindi cinema, so mythology may interpenetrate mundane life and its portrayal in other ostensibly secular film genres. Indeed, a number of film scholars have argued that the mythological genre was not so much replaced as absorbed early in the sound era by an emerging omnibus genre termed the social film. Loosely defined as a drama set in modern times, the social displays a marked preference for epic-like structure, for long, complex narratives with multiple subplots, a variety of aesthetic moods, including comedy, romance, adventure, and song and dance sequences, and stories that frequently follow families through several generations. References to the classical epics and to Hindu mythology through names, visual coding, and plot motifs are common and add a further dimension of meaning and pleasure for knowledgeable spectators. In the remainder of my talk, I want to focus on a single storyline, ultimately traceable to the epics, that has been used by numerous filmmakers. My argument will be that far from being a formula, such a story, when used by a gifted director, can contribute to reinterpretations and even radically resistant readings of conventional cultural messages. The theme I have in mind is that of the love affair between a young man from the city and a young woman from the mountains. I will explain in a moment why I consider this theme mythical, but let me begin by noting how regularly it has generated hit films. Ranging from Raj Kapoor's 1949 Barsaat, one of the films that established him as a popular actor and director, famous for its image of the star Nargis as a Kashmiri maiden swooning in the arms of the violin-playing hero, which became the logo of Kapoor's RK Studios, to Shakti Samanta's 1964 Kashmir Ki Kali, starring Shami Kapoor as the runaway son of an industrialist, and Sharmila Tagore as a flower seller in the Vale of Kashmir. To Subhash Ghai's 1999 Tal, in which a rich Bombay boy named Manav meets a mountain-dwelling dancer named Manasi. Now, as the heavily loaded names of the hero and heroine in this last film suggest, these scenarios of boy meets girl readily invoke a complex array of thematic polarities that have often been explored in Indian popular narrative. For example, the equation of man with civilization and of woman with nature. The contrast between the rustic and the urban, with the former, the rustic, being both valorized as pure, natural, and Indian, and simultaneously critiqued as coarse, backward, and jungly. And the urban, similarly, being positively valued in some cases as modern, educated, and progressive, and at the same time critiqued as westernized, callous, and corrupted. The films also explore the tension between the local, embodied in ethnic costume and cultural practice, and the cosmopolitan or national, expressed in the centrism of nationalist ideology and a pan-Indian urban lifestyle, again represented by the female and male characters respectively. In addition, such narratives often invoke the supposed innocent sensuality and sexual forwardness of the mountain maiden, both as a pretext for erotic spectacle and as a plot-driving motif. For example, with a Pahari girl boldly choosing the outsider Pardesi boy in defiance of her family and community. The union of the lovers typically occurs in the extra-social space of the snow-capped Himalayas, a realm associated with the gods, but also with the libidinous lifestyles of semi-divine beings. But then this love must later be severely tested by society and its prejudices, which typically happens down below on the plains. The successful outcome of these trials is not simply a romantic couple, but a new dynastic family, divinely chartered and blessed. There's a deliciously reflexive moment in Tal, by the way, this film, I think it's actually in this scene, just as Manav is about to go back to Bombay, he says to Manasi, "This is not going to be like one of those Hindi films in which a boy from the city falls for a girl from the mountains and then leaves her and never comes back," which is, of course, exactly what happens in the rest of the film, until the happy ending. Now, one archetype for all these tales is the story of Shakuntala, first found in the Mahabharata and later adapted by Kalidasa into the most famous of all Sanskrit dramas. Itself filmed several times as a mythological, Shakuntala tells of a semi-divine maiden born of a celestial nymph on a Himalayan peak and raised by a sage in his hermitage. A king on a hunting trip falls in love with her and seduces her into contracting a casual marriage with him, though she believes his promise that it is to be a lifelong union. But after her lover returns to his kingdom and doesn't send for her, Shakuntala, who has by now given birth to a son, makes her way to the city, where she is publicly humiliated and accused of being a loose woman. After many trials and with the intervention of the gods, Shakuntala is ultimately vindicated and reunited with the king, and her son, Bharata, becomes heir to the throne and the founder of a new dynasty, that of Bharata, or the descendants of Bharata, a label since applied to the Indian people as a whole. Since the official post-independence name of India is indeed Bharat, the Shakuntala tale is as portentous as it is popular. This he-done-her-wrong story is in fact a charter myth for the Indian nation. So the first film I want to look at is Ram Teri Ganga Meli, Ram or God, your Ganga, your Ganges is soiled, released in 1985. This was Raj Kapoor's last effort as a director, and its massive success reconfirmed his cherished title of the great showman. It is, in fact, in the grand Kapoor tradition, an ingenious epic-scale allegory that synthesizes classical narrative, political and social commentary, an audacious display of the female body. Apart from its recapitulation of the Shakuntala story, which will become obvious when I go through the synopsis briefly in a moment, It alludes to other Mahabharata motifs, that of a human prince's union with a river goddess, as well as to the myth of the divine river Ganga's descent to the human realm, now superimposed onto mundane geography to follow her meandering course over the North Indian plains from the Himalayas to the Bay of Bengal. This permits the director to offer both a spectacular travelogue and an auspicious visual pilgrimage to some of North India's most revered sites, from the source of the Ganga near the Tibetan border to her great pilgrimage center at Varanasi to her merger with the Indian Ocean at Ganga Sagar off the Bengal coast. As if this were not enough, motifs and themes from the Ramayana and from the life story of Krishna and his medieval poet devotee, the Rajput princess Meera, are also worked in. Ethnic ontogeny, national geography, Hindu mythology, and the feminization and divinization of land and nature all converge in the film's blue-eyed Himalayan heroine, Ganga, played by Kapoor's ingenue discovery, Mandakini, whose stage name evokes yet another sacred river. Like her epic prototypes, this divine forest girl meets and falls for a city boy and contracts an informal marriage with him. And then, so to speak, it is all downhill from there. There's a brief prologue depicting a rally in Calcutta to protest the pollution of the river, and then a credit sequence that alternates between scenes of the pristine Ganga of Himalayas with her debased form on the plains, graphically showing her pollution with human corpses and raw sewage, accompanied by a bhajan-style title song, complaining to Ram or God that your Ganga has now become dirty. In the first half of the film, the hero, Naren, played by Kapoor's son, Rajiv Kapoor, the idealistic son of a Calcutta industrialist, embarks on a college eco-field trip to Gangotri, intent on seeing the river in her pristine form, far from the corruption of his city. His father is in the process of plotting Naren's marriage to the daughter of a ruthless politician crony of his, and first refuses him permission to go. But Naren gets it through the intervention of his pious wheelchair-bound grandmother, who gives him a metal urn and begs him to, quote, bring Ganga back to me. Once in the Himalayas, Naren's group settles into a holiday camp serviced by local mountain folk. While ecstatically roaming the hills nearby, Naren has his first encounter with Ganga the girl in a scene that is full of mythic resonances.
गंगा लेने आए हैं गंगा लेके जाएंगे ओ गंगा लेने आए हैं गंगा लेके कौन है कौन है तुम मैं पूछा
गले लगाओगे तो गंगा को कैसे ले जाओगे साहेब
क्यों
एक कदम आगे बढ़ के देखो क्या है
कौन हो तुम
तुम्हारी जिंदगी
मेरी जिंदगी
हाँ जिंदगी और मौत बता के थोड़ी आती है तुम्हें बचना था इसलिए मैं आ गई पर साहेब बगैर जान पहचान के गंगा को कैसे ले जाओगे
इस लुटिया में
साहेब सच बताओ तुम इंसान हो या देवता
क्यों
शंकर जी ने तो अपनी जटा में गंगा मैया को जाने कब संभाल लिया था अब आज तुम आए हो जो अपनी लुटिया में मुझे ले जाओगे?
तुम्हें कहाँ ले जाऊंगा?
अभी तो कहा तुमने गंगा को लेने आए हो, मैं ही तो हूँ गंगा।
गंगा?
हाँ।
Okay. Is there a chair anywhere down here? John? There's a chair. Just be careful of the cord here. Yeah. So Ganga is first experienced through her tinkling laughter and then rises yakshi-like from a field of wildflowers to announce, "I am Ganga." It is, of course, love at first darshan for both young people. And their bond is cemented shortly thereafter when Naren saves Ganga from an attempted rape by a college rowdy and then accompanies her on a walking pilgrimage to the river's source. Ganga's first song, "Tujhe Bulaye Ye Meri Bahe," has become rather notorious, "My Arms Call Out to You." It establishes her as both innocent and seductive as she bathes in a waterfall and repeatedly calls out, "Aja Re, oh come to me." Kapoor's reputation as the great showman rested in part on his willingness to repeatedly push the envelope on how much of the female body government censors would permit filmmakers to show on screen. From Nargis's wave-making bathing suit in the 1951 Avara, to Dimple Kapadia's skimpy two-piece in 1973 Bobby, to Zeena Taman's blouseless mini-sari in Satyam Shivam Sundaram in 1978. Mandakini's bath in the waterfall, witnessed by a dumbfounded Naren, is the equivalently scandalous scene here. The sight of such an apsara bathing in a waterfall is naturally an erotic invitation, and the hero is quick to respond. Conveniently, there soon follows a full moon festival at which mountain girls are supposedly allowed to choose their own husbands. Ganga sings to Naren, "Sun Sahiba Sun, listen, beloved, I have chosen you, will you choose me?" Then she leads him into a ruined temple that has been adorned as a bridal chamber, while outside her stalwart brother fights off a jilted local fiancé and his buddies, ultimately sacrificing his life for his sister's happiness. Incidentally, that's a cameo by the American actor Tom Alter, who was very proud of the fact that he finally got to play an Indian role in this film. He plays a, you know, Pahari fellow. Alas, that happiness is not destined to last. After a single blissful night, Naren returns to Calcutta with his school group, promising to come back soon to fetch Ganga. Instead, he finds the family mansion adorned for his own engagement to the politician's daughter. And when he tries to tell his grandmother that he is already married, she suffers a heart attack. He attempts to escape to rejoin Ganga, but is apprehended by police sent by his father and brought back to Calcutta a virtual prisoner, as plans for his marriage proceed. The mise-en-scene now alternates between Naren's trials in Calcutta and the advancement of Ganga's pregnancy against the backdrop of changing seasons in the Himalayas. She sings of her viraha as autumn leaves flutter down and gives birth to a son, of course, as snow falls on the hills. Yet when Naren still fails to appear by the following spring, and a misdirected letter reveals details of his planned marriage in Calcutta, the distraught Ganga resolves to go to the city to seek him. She intends to make no claim on Naren, who she thinks has rejected her, but only wants him to accept their son. Ganga's trials now take a more demeaning turn. Traveling alone with her infant, the innocent girl, who knows only that Calcutta is a place, quote, where the Ganga ends, unquote, is waylaid by a succession of exploiters. The denizens of a cheap brothel in Rishikesh, a lecherous Brahmin priest in Haridwar who tries to rape her, and finally a wily procurer for a high-class courtesan house in Benares who is drawn by her beautiful voice. Though some viewers might wince at the film's relentless depiction of the helpless vulnerability of a young mother lacking the protection of a male escort, the type of situations depicted and the satire of exploitative North Indian types is, alas, not altogether exaggerated, especially given the fact that many prostitutes in Bombay and other cities are in fact said to be abducted Himalayan girls. Nor is Ganga entirely without agency. She fights back, repeatedly attempts escape, and hurls sarcasm at her abusers and would-be corruptors. Throughout this numbing descent of Ganga personified, there are ironic allusions to the sacred status of the river for which she is named that reflect on the hypocrisy of formal religion, as in a scene when an elderly woman on a train refuses Ganga a sip of water for her sick infant because it is precious Ganga jal that she has obtained on a pilgrimage. After a dance performance in a pavilion on the bank of the holy river in Banaras, Ganga is ultimately sold to none other than the corrupt politician from Calcutta who is Naren's father's crony and Naren's future father-in-law, thus paving the way for the film's climax when Ganga is brought to sing and dance at Naren's wedding to the politician's daughter. Kapoor pulls out all the stops during this sequence, following a double entendre-laden bhajan with a series of seemingly irresolvable dharma dilemmas, escalating dramatic speeches, and even a somewhat surprising ending. As an ideological statement, Ram Teri Ganga Meli displays some characteristic tendencies of Raj Kapoor's work, and indeed of much mainstream Hindi cinema. The ultimate reduction of social conflict to family squabbles that can be resolved through love and faith, and the combination of progressive messages about women's agency and honor with the relentless display of their bodies and the stereotyping of their social roles within an unquestioned patriarchal framework. Yet like all of Kapoor's best work, and I'm thinking especially of his 1950s masterpieces Avara and Sri Charsobis, it also presents a visual and textual richness that can support variant readings. The director's skillful use of classical narrative and epic mythology is especially noteworthy here. Like her namesake river Ganga, the daughter of the Himalayas, the heroine descends to bless the urbanized plains and in the process becomes polluted by them, though in the end her inherent purity is affirmed. Male and female, culture and nature, plains and mountains come together in the film's final moments to forge an independent nuclear family that optimistically suggests the possibility of a new national era. But a far less optimistic prognosis emerges from my reading of Maniratnam's 1998 film, Dilse, a film that again rehearses the trope of an idealistic urban boy falling in love with a mysterious mountain girl, but this time in the service of an unsettling narrative set against the background of insurgent and counterinsurgent violence in the eastern Himalayan region. Current superstar Shah Rukh Khan plays a frenetic Delhi yuppie, ironically named Amar, an All India Radio reporter dispatched to the mountains in 1997 to collect sunny news stories on the theme, quote, "What 50 years of independence have done for you," unquote. But instead of happy peasants, he finds barbed wire, bitterness, and secessionist ethnic rebels. His hyperactivity is counterbalanced by Manisha Koirala's portrayal of Meghna, the cloudy one, a brooding waif whom he encounters en route, and whose coldness conceals past traumas and deadly secrets. The hero sets out with sheer exuberance to tame this beautiful and elusive shrew, a stock plotline in Bombay romances. But in this case, the results are unexpected and increasingly ominous. It seems that Meghna is already married, not to another man, but to a cause that the hero cannot fathom. After the interval, the action shifts to New Delhi, where, as in Shakuntala, the heroine follows the hero to his capital city. Yet Meghna is not seeking to renew their relationship, but rather to participate as a female suicide bomber in a plot to assassinate the President of India during the annual Republic Day parade. Stumbling on this conspiracy, Amar soon runs afoul of both the plotters and the heavy-handed government intelligence team working frantically to stop them. The film's jarring and decidedly unhappy ending, and forgive me for giving it away if you haven't seen the film, in which Amar embraces Meghna knowing that she has been dressed as a human bomb, disturbed many viewers, though this and other non-standard features have also won the film fans. Indeed, throughout Dilse, director Maniratnam plays with Hindi film conventions, setting up audience expectations and then repeatedly frustrating them. He skillfully uses the trope of the unremittingly ardent, though initially unrequited, male lover, a role portrayed by Shah Rukh Khan himself in numerous prior films, and itself a reincarnation of a narcissistic hero type popularized by Raj and Shami Kapoor, among others. He uses this to create the expectation that the heroine's iciness will gradually melt, because this is the usual outcome of such pursuit. He further baits viewers with hints that this is actually occurring, as when Meghna briefly loosens up and even jokes with Amar during a foot journey in Ladakh. But Meghna is no demure mountain maid, playfully resisting the hero's wooing while actually desiring it. When she repeatedly tells Amar to leave her alone, she seems to mean it. He, of course, ignores such protests. And when he finally attempts to kiss her, she goes into a spasm of violent and seemingly involuntary gagging. Her revulsion to physical contact with a man is ultimately explained in a horrific flashback near the film's end, to a childhood scene of her snow-covered village being attacked by government soldiers, who shoot most of the inhabitants, burn their homes, and rape Meghna's older sister and then the 12-year-old herself. Though rape is not an unusual occurrence in post-1970s mainstream cinema, the child's eye view of it presented here and its shocking perpetration by agents of the state robs it of any potential as titillating spectacle, even as it acknowledges the existence of government-sponsored terror. Far from being idyllic rustics, the survivors of the mountain massacre become determined secessionists, fighting back through terrorism to secure their own homeland. In the face of this, Amar's bouncy but clueless and self-centered character offers, in my reading, an ironic commentary on the official state discourse of national integration which he espouses. As All India Amar labors manfully to lure Meghna into a lasting union based on his ideals, he demands that she forget past injustices and literal violations. His implicit message is, just love me and everything will be all right. But this appears increasingly idiotic as we learn more about her past. His love is as selfish as it is passionate, and both blind to and uninterested in the reality of the girl's traumatic past. Dilse is especially notable for its musical sequences, brilliantly scored by A.R. Rahman to haunting Urdu lyrics by S.S. Gulzar. They combine folkish melodies and driving rhythms with Indo-Persian ghazal imagery and hypnotic rap-style declamation. With wonderful outdoor cinematography by Santosh Shivan, the songs span the subcontinent from the high-altitude deserts of Ladakh to the backwaters of Kerala to offer, in a jarring counterpoint to the screenplay, an idealized portrait of the undivided body of Bharat Mata. And they evoke also the Indian national anthem's sweeping catalog of geographic and ethnic regions, Punjab, Sindh, Gujarat, Maratha, etc., welded into national unity under benign rulers. But though the songs are inserted more or less diegetically into the story, they are jarringly discontinuous with its storyline and dialogue, which makes their precise nature unclear. Uncoded as dream sequences or fantasies, they might be taken as the reveries of Amar, or of Meghna, or of neither. Perhaps they are simply glimpses of a parallel reality, such as that of some other previous film, in which the loving union of these two protagonists was still possible. In the most striking such sequence, while Amar and Meghna journey on foot across the Ladakh plateau and he relentlessly tries to break down her resistance, the song Satarangi Re presents the two as passionate lovers, literally united by nets and draperies, as well as by erotic choreography, accompanied by lyrics that offer no lilting romantic cliches, but rather a hard-edged portrait of obsessive and doomed infatuation. We have a little clip from this song here.
राहों में उलझा उलझा हूँ तेरी बाहों में उलझा उलझा सुलझाने दे होश मुझे तेरी, चाहो मैं उलझाऊं। मेरा जीना जुनू, मेरा मरना जुनू, अब इसके सिवा नहीं कोई सुकून। मेरा जीना जुनू, मेरा मरना जुनू, अब इसके सिवा नहीं कोई सुकून। मेरा जीना जुनू, मेरा मरना जुनू।
There were, I am entangled in your ways, entangled in your embrace. Let me disentangle my wits. I am snared by your desires. I am possessed by living, possessed by dying. Save this, there is no peace. You, only you of the many-colored spirit. And then there's a line from Ghalib. Love is an uncontrollable fire, O Ghalib. It cannot be started on a whim and cannot be extinguished even if you try. In this sequence, Ratnam uses the cinematic convention of the Himalayan love song to great ironic effect, placing his non-lovers in an inhospitable but authentic mountain landscape that bespeaks extremes of light, darkness, heat, cold, and emotion. It ends, as mountain love songs sometimes do, in a snowfield on which the lovers embrace. Incidentally, I have an article about this, which is just about to come out, called Sex in the Snow. But then it immediately lays Amar, clad in a shroud-like dhoti, immobile across Meghna's lap, in an image that is at once a pieta and a liebestod. It is an image that prefigures the film's grim finale and the lyric that will accompany it, which is a reprise of this song, Satrangire. Let me sleep in the womb of death. Let me drown my body in your soul, O seven-colored one. Ratnam's persistent use of dislocation in song sequences contributes to the uneasy unfolding of his storyline and appears deliberately intended to mirror not just the eventual fate of the film's protagonists, but the potential one of the nation-state that they embody. In my reading of Dilse, the romantic union of mountain maiden and plains prince is apparently no longer possible in the mundane world except in the most hyperbolic fantasy. When it occurs, it results not in a harmonious new national family, but in a horrific and suicidal act of disintegration. Here, the evocation of mythology contributes not to the nationalist triumphalism so characteristic of Hindi cinema, but rather to its interrogation. Thank you.
No scenes that you have presented, there is a contrast between them. One is with vegetation,
yes,
and one absolutely no vegetation.
Yeah.
And the next thing you have presented here, in terms of your two main films, what I call intrasocial relationship, which is permitted by the society. And the tale of Shiva Parvati is the proto. Model of everything that follows. And the other one.
Yeah, actually, in the written version of this that I just mentioned, I actually talk about the Shiva Parvati story a bit. Yeah.
And the other is extra social. And extra social depends upon the status of the sibling, male sibling in the family. The older sibling will go Sitaram.
Yeah.
And the younger sibling will go Radha.
Krishna, Radha, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they both end in tragedy. And now there is a third element involved here. Snow with vegetation. You can have plenty of sex with snow with vegetation around.
Uh-huh.
But no sex here. Because yeah. all dry, barren.
Yes, this is, yeah.
She's a barren woman. She cannot reproduce.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just few additions.
Yeah, yeah.
That struck me.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot more details one can go into.
Yeah.
There's a lot buried in here.
Mm-hmm.
But Hindi cinema operates on these three models. One way or the other. You have to have a happy life forever,
mm-hmm.
or no life at all.
Well, your point about siblings certainly works for a lot of films. I think in neither of these films do we get enough information about the heroes to know whether they are younger brother or older brother. In fact,
there can be only a sibling. Only
they're not represented as having
the
siblings
only
that we know about.
There are three things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the sibling status matters only in extra social tales. And there can be only son, but it depends upon what's the status of the woman he marries is. He can marry the oldest one, and there'll be a tug of war. They'll fight all their life. He can marry a middle sibling who will submit. He can marry the youngest daughter of the family who will be absolutely submissive. And these distinctions are not only part of mythology, but also it works in the families too. We treat our sons and daughters like this. So these are just a few things which will lead you to many more things in the
mm-hmm.
movies.
Thank you.
Just a few.
Yeah. I should just, look, if I could just say one thing, that, you know, talking about mythology, I don't in any sense mean to be reductive or to suggest that all Hindi films can be reduced to mythological formulas. I simply think that it's one interesting dimension from which certain films can be approached, and you can learn more about them by looking at them that way. I'm not proposing this as an overarching typology that all films must be crammed into by any means. Even all films about boys from the city meeting girls from the mountains. But I think it's interesting, and for these two films, for me, it was productive of different ways of looking at them. You know, when I first saw Dilse, I didn't particularly like it. I found it a very disturbing film, and watching it more and more, I found it more and more interesting. And it led me to this particular interpretation of what it's saying. And I know there are many other people have many other interpretations of that particular film. And, you know, it's part of the pleasure of films is the richness of them and the multiple layers of the film text that can generate so many different interpretations. Anyway, but other comments? See if...
One more brief thing. Where does Santoshima fit in here?
Well, I only gave Santoshima as an example because I use the term mythological, and because mythological is a genre category.
But it established the myth of Santoshima.
Yes, uh-huh.
And
I would say that.
The followers of the myth
mm-hmm.
is the girl whom you showed on the screen and her husband.
In the film,
yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
And it's also sold as a katha.
Right.
Women observe it.
Yeah.
And what they do is listen to this katha.
Right. Yeah. Yes, I didn't say much about Santoshima. I have another whole thing on Santoshima, but I didn't really go into that here.
William.
Professor, thank you so much for that presentation. This question is, I guess, a little tangential to your main presentation, but I would love to have your thoughts on this question. One thing that struck me was your comment that we shouldn't think of these mythological formulas is just formulas, that they can, mm-hmm. their presence in contemporary film can be a way of resisting certain interpretations. And your use of Dilse made me wonder about this aspect of the role of mythology in thinking through contemporary issues. Do you see Indian film managing to think through war or violence using anything of the mythology of war that we have in India? And the reason I'm asking this is just your opinion on it. You know that Stanley Lombardo chose a picture of Omaha Beach for his cover of a translation of the Iliad. And that has stayed with me. This is a very striking thing to do. And I've always wondered how Indian film handles situations like Kashmir or Assam.
Yeah. That's a good question, and it's something that I haven't thought much about. War films are a very small genre in Hindi cinema, but there have been some significant big ones in recent years, Border, most notably.
Are they as adroit with the mythology as these films?
And, you know, I don't have a website. On my website, I have notes on a lot of films, and Border is not a film that I've written on. I saw it, you know, it didn't make that much of an impression on me, so I haven't really thought about it or looked that carefully to know. I mean, does it allude to the Mahabharata, for example, which is what one might expect in a war film? But I really don't know, so I can't really answer that question. There's been a whole spate of films on Kashmir. A lot of cinema, of course, especially in the late 90s, begins going back and looking at partition again, you know, from the comfortable distance of a generation and, you know, really two generations and the 50th anniversary, you know. And so you get a whole bunch of films that think about partition, sometimes in ways that invoke narrative, Mahabharata, Ramayana, sundered families, exile, you know. Films like Pinjar and Hey Ram and Gadar, and there's Vizara. A whole Virzara as well, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Virzara, very Ramayana-esque, and also Indo-Persian kind of Sufi Prema Kyan kind of formula. I'm actually screening Virzara in my class next week. That's our last film.
And is there any sense in these films, or do you think that you can have a wasteland without having to go to Ladakh? You can stay in the valley of Kashmir, but it's a jungle. It's uninhabited.
I don't know. I mean, do you have a particular film in mind that you're?
This is why I was asking.
Yeah. Gee, does anybody have an answer to that? I mean.
Did you want to come in on that, Bulbul?
Oh,
it's
a different question. Oh, okay. Should be some film in Rajasthan.
Yeah, I mean, sure, there are films set in. That's true. There are films set in Rajasthan. I mean, if you think of Fiza, for example, which is a film about. A Muslim boy who becomes a terrorist as a result of communal violence directed against his family in the Bombay riots of 1993. He ends up in Rajasthan, you know, in the desert, in this kind of terrorist cell, and then ultimately dies, ultimately sort of, in effect, commits suicide to prevent himself from carrying out a terrorist act. But, I mean, again, these are just... they're interesting questions, but they don't automatically bring to mind particular good examples to me. Sorry. Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. Hi, William.
How's it going?
Good.
I had a question about the relationship between, on the one hand, you tell the story about sort of a movement towards a more complex and sometimes ironic take on some of the kind of mythological topoi that we used here, and it makes me wonder about the relationship between that and sort of formal questions of Indian film aesthetics, particularly given that we're comparing Raj Kapoor sort of from the very sort of in some ways identified as sort of being at the very core of the sort of post-independence formation of the Hindi film, and Maniratnam, who comes from Chennai, and brings with him to Hindi film something which is often recognized as formal devices and aesthetic modes that are more quote unquote realist in the kind of Western filmic sort of the Hollywood sense. I mean, often his films like Roja and Bombay and Dilse are also sort of thought to be sort of aesthetically blends of certain kinds of Bollywood conventions with sort of both in terms of form and content, a certain kind of realist mode borrowed from Hollywood or adapted from Hollywood. And I'm wondering about the relationship between the sort of the formal experimentation or the formal shifts that someone like an outsider to, in a sense, the mainstream of Hindi filmmaking like Maniratnam can bring, and the forms of commentary that that kind of enables in its in the use of certain kinds of mythological themes.
Well, you know, personally, I wouldn't buy the argument that Ratnam is more realist than if, say the late Raj Kapoor films. I mean, a hyper surreal film like Ram Teri Ganga Maili. Well, actually, it's not. I mean, it's fairly.
The question can only be asked with the acknowledgement that there are many forms of realism in operation.
I mean, I think one of the things you're talking about is, for example, certain shifting conventions of representation.
Yeah.
For example, Maniratnam uses a lot more location and very little soundstage. Whereas in Raj Kapoor's era, there was still doing a lot of soundstage. A lot of the Banaras stuff in Ram Teri Ganga Maili is all done on sound. It's obviously not really Banaras, although the stuff in the Himalayas is actually shot up there.
But Maniratnam also uses a lot more sort of quasi-documentary devices, for instance, which can
give me
a
for instance.
Kind
of, are you thinking? Are you thinking of Bombay?
Bombay, for instance.
Yeah.
But also, I think Dilse.
But you know, Bombay has these hyper surreal moments in it.
Sure.
I mean, like the love scene between
the
couple.
That's what I'm saying. It's like a kind of blend.
Yeah.
At certain points, it's almost like the sort of handheld camera, sort of the news reportage sort of mode, which really could not have found a place in, say,
No, absolutely not. And, you know, Raj Kapoor never watched MTV, so, you know, he did song sequences differently, too. Everybody who's been making films through the 90s has been influenced by certain kinds of aesthetic principles that come from television. And you know, Maniratnam has been influenced a lot by The Godfather and other films.
Some of the people most associated with those kind of transformations are southerners.
Ram
Gopal Varma.
Absolutely,
Maniratnam.
Yeah. And we actually, my colleague Corey Kriegmer and I, who co-teach courses on Hindi cinema, we have a very talented graduate student who's currently in India doing his field work, who's going to be writing a history of the Tamil. The great Tamil studios, which were later than what people think of as the great Bombay studios. They lasted all the way into the 70s. And he is a very well, he is Tamil, and he's very well situated to do this. He's a former filmmaker himself. And I think it's going to really add to our understanding. What I'm leading up to is my sense from conversations with this man. His name is Pillai, Iswaran Pillai, is that really, there was always a lot more cross-fertilization going on between Tamil and Telugu cinema and Hindi cinema than most of us who are kind of newer to the field and are approaching it only through the Hindi film side, which is my own limitation, much more than we realize. I mean, there's always been a lot of aesthetic influence coming from the South, and of course actors and actresses, but also directors. And directors who crossed over and started making films in Hindi. So I think Ratnam and Ram Gopal Varma are you know, recent examples of this, but actually it's been going on for a long time.
This is somewhat related. I really enjoyed your talk, and I'm a fan of your work in general.
Oh, thank you.
I just want to preface that this sounds somewhat critical.
Okay, here it comes.
From my understanding of your talk, you're interested in genre, basically, in defining it, and you sort of give us this genealogy that, as you said yourself, is familiar from Tracy, from Palki down. And then you sort of switch, and you make this wonderful reading of Dilse in that particular scene. I love those readings of it, and basically you end up doing a sort of auteur theory type thing in this conversation with Maniratnam. You sort of switch approaches, and on some level what you're saying, you're sort of defining as there's an obvious mythological, and this is sort of a more implicit, say, mythological, right? So you're saying the genre has complicated itself, but My question is, why is this defined as, why can't you just say it's intertextuality or a self-reflexive cinema? What you would apply in, for example, Western cinema,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Indian film, everything always has to go back to the roots,
mm-hmm.
the tradition, the
mm-hmm.
origin, and all those comes, you know, with like the ancient way back into like, is it just
mm-hmm.
because of your particular training and bias, or because, I mean...
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And I was going to put a final frame on here in which I was going to really underscore what I'm not trying to do. And one of the things was going to be essentialism, and the other one was going to be orientalism, and they were going to have slashes through them, you know, the no button, right? No, you know, I mean, well, you're right in that I start talking about, I mean, genre is a really slippery word in all film studies. And it's really particularly sloppily used in relation to Indian cinema. So when I talk about the mythological as a category that's used in the has been used in the film industries in India, it's merely a convenient label that people there use to refer to certain kinds of films that generally come out of epic Puranic type narrative. Okay. And because that has played a key historical role in the development of cinema in India, that's where why the talk begins with that. But what's interesting in Hindi film, to me at least, is the fact that, you know, with the exception of an occasional film, they're really mythologicals really die out. And they disappear very early on. Nobody makes them anymore. And yet, there is a great deal of allusion to mythology in later films, and that's what I use then to discuss those two films. In terms of talking about intertextuality, I love talking about it. I mean, I use that word a lot, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate term to use, and if you're more comfortable with that, fine, that's good. No, I mean, I think that's another way of saying some of the same things that I said in the talk. Does that?
Yes. I mean, you're aware of them, and I know you're
I'm not. I'm not saying that all films harken back to some mythical source.
I'm interested why you need to do that, but it makes complete sense. I mean, it's not like it's nonsensory. It's interesting for that. It's just that the impulse to do so is just more present in Hindi cinema than any other cinema studies,
but,
and that makes me
somewhat
uncomfortable.
But I would say that myth and epic play a more foregrounded role in popular culture in South Asia than they do in many other parts of the world. And they're not totally dominant, and they're not exclusive, less and less so perhaps as time goes on and as more and more types of entertainment become available and popular. But still, they're very much there. And I do continue to feel that, I mean, for example, when I teach undergraduates and when I teach people who are going to be going on study abroad programs in India, I feel like they should know the basic story of the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, because they're going to see references to it all over the place. And it's going to help them to understand, you know, to feel comfortable culturally at home and to understand what they're seeing and what's going on around them. I don't mean to boil